Across the sea, somewhere over in Italy, Vanzetti born, parents fine, drank the best Italian wine. Sacco sailed to sea one day, landed up in the Boston Bay.
Welcome back. Vanzetti sailed the... Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with Charles Cobb. Of course, that was Woody Guthrie, born on this day. And we're talking to Charles Cobb, who is a former leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was a field secretary with them. He's been a visiting professor at Brown University's Department of Africana Studies, an active in the National Association of Black Journalists, been a writer for many, many years, lives in Jackson, Florida, and has written this book, which just blew me away, actually, and no pun intended. This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. And Charlie Cobb, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. This book, I thought, you know, when people look at this book, and some people told me about the book in the beginning, a very different picture is painted when you see books that are coming out in print. Especially with America's kind of obsession with violence in the black community. Let me just start this way. It seems to me that part of the overarching theme of this book is that it's kind of rewriting and retelling of our history, of the civil rights history, because it's always been defined as a nonviolent movement. And what you're doing here is redefining it with all its complexity and reality, saying it wasn't – nonviolence was just what they wanted us to see. It's much more than that, because it's, if you look at history from bottom up, it's a different story.
Exactly. You put your finger on the problem. What the book is trying to do really is begin to fill in some of the gaps of movement history, both by – telling stories, if you will, that don't usually make it into the historical narrative, and also making the point that when we talk about black struggle, we're not talking about some series of isolated events in the 1960s, the March on Washington or the Selma March. But there's a whole long tradition going back to slave revolts, in fact, of black struggle. So a lot of this book emerges from my attempt to fill in some of these gaps. And one of the reasons we have this gap is because movement history, indeed much of American history, is typically approached from the top down instead of the bottom up. And when you look at the civil rights movement from the bottom up, you really get a different view of the movement than you do when you look at iconic figures or charismatic figures or mass protests in public spaces.
Because for you in this analysis, also in your interviews and your remembrances of being in the South during the civil rights movement, what you're doing is telling the story of the intense part of this book, the intense interaction that took place between the young civil rights workers of especially the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee of SNCC, but also of CORE, and the people who lived in these places, lived under racist terror of Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina. And that interaction really is another giant piece of the story, how it changed both communities fundamentally.
Yeah, I'm saying that what you see if you look particularly at the movement from the bottom up and you look at the movement in rural areas, first you see a convergence of young people like myself. I was 19 years old when I went to Mississippi. A convergence of young people with older people who were willing to share their experience and their networks in terms of the struggle that unfolded. Much of this is a story of the rural South. And if you're in the rural South, an important piece of the culture of the rural South, black or white, in fact, which is what I address in the book, is guns. People use them for hunting because these were largely poor communities. People use them to keep varmints out of gardens that they had, and people use them for self-defense. All of this transcended race.
And I'm going to take that history back a bit because there's some things in here I think are really – I mean, this whole book is to me critically important because I think it's a story that has not been put forth not just talking about civil rights but in terms of American history. And as you talk about, go ahead. I'm sorry, Charlie.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
And the role of not just violence, but the role of of how violence played in black history. One of the things you say in here is, and I really find this really interesting, when you looked at the time around Reconstruction and Redemption, and which the period you call the Nadir. You talk about that even though there was self-defense going on and people stood up and fought for their communities, something happened to the psyche because of the overwhelming response from Reconstruction on of absolute violence in the face of self-defense. That changed the psyche both of white folks, but especially of African-American community in the South.
Yeah, you had even before that, there is some considerable history of slave revolts, and of course weapons are used in slave revolts. But what happens after the Civil War is that you have these men, really, who had fought with the Union Army coming back home armed, and combat always changes you. You know, these guys had been used now to shooting at Confederate soldiers, so they were less inclined to accept, you know, the structures of white supremacy that still remained in place after the Civil War. And what you see, and we don't have nearly enough time to go into this at this time, but what you see are the formation of not just political organizations for the purpose of engaging in politics, but you also see the formation of what were really called union leagues, aimed at defending the people who were beginning to engage in political process, engaging in protecting newly freed slaves. This is the period that historian Vincent Harding, who passed away 2 months ago, called the Great Period of Black Protest. And the book follows that theme through World Wars I and World Wars II as well. Men who had become used to shooting at white people in war were not going to come back home and easily accept white supremacy at home.
So
part of the tradition of black struggle that is often ignored.
And I think what I was trying to do, and I didn't do it very eloquently, let me try this again, because I know we cannot get into all the nuances that this book brings to us, which is why I think it's a very important book to read. But when you wrote about, let me just read one little piece of this and tie it to a piece at the end, so we can just talk about this, mm-hmm. just in terms of the violence. When you write, after the Houston riots happened, which we can describe briefly, and what happened in Colfax, Louisiana, during the Reconstruction, part of writing the book is this. You say, These clashes you're talking about and the aftermath demonstrated to blacks a lesson learned during Reconstruction and Redemption in the previous century, that the use of firepower was not likely to defeat the coordinated power of a wrathful federal and local authorities reacting to black anger and aspiration. It's a lesson that's endured in black consciousness. And then you said, then and now teaches that the blacks should never underestimate the level of violence you brought to bear against them by white authority, and they should never overestimate the prospects for receiving understanding and support from white people. And then at the end of the book, where you also talk about what young SNCC workers understood about, came in as a kind of nonviolent theory, but began to understand about self-defense and how people looked at that in the community, and that was transformative as well. But there's a direct link to me between these two.
Yes. Remember, the reason for self-defense when we were working in the South in the 1960s was because of white terrorism or Ku Klux Klan terrorism that took various forms that we got no protection from either local authority or federal authority. Very much the same as it was after the Civil War. And most of the black leaders and local supporters of the movement who were grown-ups had realized this long before we did. Remember, we're coming out of a nonviolent protest movement that has really largely been based in cities, sitting in at lunch counters or even freedom riding, into the rural South. And there's a whole body of experience there that we really didn't know very much about until we began to embed ourselves in these communities. And all of these adults, virtually without exception, understood that when it came down to questions of self-defense, A, you had to be very practical in your use of it and very practical in your use of weapons, and B, that you would be foolish to expect help from either local authorities or national authorities. J. Edgar Hoover, the federal FBI, in charge of the federal FBI, was hostile to the Southern movement. Or typically, and say, take Amite County, Mississippi, the head of the Ku Klux Klan was the sheriff's son. So there's no reason to expect help. So people use their guns, and they were very practical in terms of when they chose to use them. And those practicalities I describe in the book range from organizing a group like the Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana to individual acts of self-defense in these rural communities. But they do not involve guerrilla warfare or assaults with arms on the county courthouse or something like that. People really had learned, beginning with the dismemberment of Reconstruction in the late 19th century, all the way into the 60s when we were working in the South, when it was practical to engage in self-defense. And when maybe you want to do, as one man I stayed with did, jump into the iron bathtub.
Right.
when the Knight Riders attacked.
I mean, one of the things that struck me about this book, and I really, why I thought it was so important, was that it is a piece of the history that people don't understand. I'll tell a quick little story here and then relate this back to your book, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
In Cambridge, Maryland, there was a man named Mr. Jackson, mm-hmm. who was the father of the now mayor of Cambridge, the first African-American mayor of Cambridge. And during the civil rights movement, he would drive around with a 45 and a 38 under his seat and a shotgun pasted to the back of his truck or the car, whatever he was ferrying us around in at the moment. And while we were demonstrating and getting beaten up and going to jail, he would never pull out a gun. But he always said the gun was there. They were there because no one's going to take us out. And there were shotguns in every floor of the Freedom Houses you write in your book. And that one of the things I think people don't get from this, was I think is an important part of your book, is that the idea that nonviolent people who are trying to use nonviolence as a tactic coming into the South and Southern areas to fight segregation, to end the racial terrorism, and the black farmers and rural people who were there who were willing to stand up and already had weapons used mostly for self-defense in case Knight Riders came in or for hunting or whatever they needed, as you describe in the book. There was this kind of that symbiotic relationship took place, changed both parties. I mean, it made self-defense in some ways more organized, and it opened the eyes to kind of idealistic young people that nonviolence was a tactic, not a way of life. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah, but here you have to make, there's an important distinction to be made. You know, when you talk about the conscious use of nonviolent tactics and strategies, you really are talking about the kinds of protests as unfolded in Cambridge, Maryland, where you were, for example, aimed at desegregation.
Right.
And they were largely in cities.
Right.
Even Cambridge is a small city. I mean, compared to the little town I lived in
right.
Sunflower County, Mississippi, which had 1,100 people,
right.
Cambridge would seem like New York. So, and in doing those sit-ins in places like Cambridge or Birmingham or any number of cities where a nonviolent protest took place, the decision on being nonviolent rested with the protester. The violence was directed at the protester. So you could be sitting on a lunch counter and somebody attacks you And you could say, I can't do this, or I can't accept this. That's one kind of thing. In the rural areas, however, you know, you weren't sitting in. I mean, where are you going to sit in Louisville, Mississippi?
Right.
Well, maybe the gas station, restaurant, you know, someplace like that. And, you know, there's no Woolworth. There's no nothing there except cotton plantations and cotton gin and stuff like that. So the question of nonviolence, which was really associated with sit-ins, hardly ever came up. You were there doing voter registration. When violence occurred because you were doing voter registration, it wasn't just directed at you. There was collective punishment. Whole communities were attacked. You know, they put bombs under churches, or night marauders came through shooting up homes in a whole community. That's really qualitatively different.
Yes. Yes.
Than what you experienced in Cambridge, Maryland. And in those communities, you know, and we were never confronted with this as sit-in students. If the marauders come through, and first I should make the point that I never stayed in a home anywhere in the rural South that didn't have a shotgun in the corner or a rifle up on the mantle or a pistol on the night table or something like that. So guns were present. And that when the night marauders came through attacking the community, you had the option, which you didn't have in a nonviolent protest, say at a Woolworth lunch counter, of grabbing the rifle off the wall or the shotgun from the corner and firing back at the night marauders and chasing them away. That's part of the culture in the South, black or white again. So it's important to make this distinction about the relationship of guns, geographical in part. The rural South and working in the rural South is not the same thing as working in Atlanta, Georgia, or Charlotte, North Carolina, or Cambridge, Maryland, for that matter. Although in Cambridge, I remember Cambridge, I was a Howard University student. You know, there were plenty of guns around in Cambridge, as many as you would see in any rural town. And the person I remember most, you perhaps met him, Pop Singleton.
Yes, yes.
You know, had plenty of weapons around.
So the reason I raise that was because I think that when you talk about people in your book, Frederick Douglass Kirkpatrick or any of the others who stood up.
On the deacons.
The deacons,
yeah.
Right. And the other men and women who stood up and were willing to kind of say, Fannie Lou Hamer's mother, anybody who was willing to say that you come to my doorstep, I'm going to send you back to your maker. People who had that kind of spine, and a lot of them were veterans, as you write about, who came back from World War II and Korea.
Veterans are extremely important. Not just Civil War veterans, but the veterans of World War I, and especially the veterans of World War II, which was a group that mostly affected us as young people in the 1960s.
So let's talk about that for a moment.
All the people who led us, you know, who put the person who put voter registration, for instance, on SNCC's table was Amsie Moore, a World War II veteran. Who would become a local NAACP leader in Bolivar County, Mississippi. The people who embraced us in Mississippi, Vernon Dahmer down in Hattiesburg, Aaron Henry, the state president of the NAACP, and other men like Medgar Evers, they were all World War II veterans. And they were the ones who were leading us. SNCC hadn't even given any thought to voter registration before Amsie Moore came to SNCC's second conference and put it on the table. And he came to SNCC's second conference because Ella Baker had introduced Bob Moses to Amsie Moore, and Amsie was quick to tell Bob, he says, I admire you sit-in students. You know, I admire what you're doing, but I'm not interested in that here in my little town. And in my rural county, what I think we need is some black power, and the way to get that is through voter registration. I mean, these guys were the ones who who, when, and the Deacons for Defense and Justice was mainly made up of World War II and Korean War veterans. The NACP of Monroe, North Carolina, and Union County, North Carolina, led by Robert Williams, was mostly made up of World War II veterans. The group in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that protected Martin Luther King's organization in that violent, Klan-ridden city, were World War II veterans and Korean War veterans. And we look across the South, both individually and as organized groups, World War II veterans formed the heart of the civil rights movement, and they formed the heart of the men who were prepared to protect us with their guns. And they were quick to tell you, you know, we're not nonviolent, so we're not going to sit in. None of these guys is going to sit in. But they would also tell you, and we're not going to let these white people kill you.
We are here talking with Charlie Cobb. Charles Cobb is an American scholar and journalist, a veteran of the Civil Rights Movement and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who's written what I think is one of the seminal works about that period of history, "This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible." We'll be right back with Charlie Cobb and your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Stay with us.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized.
Coming back, yeah, that's Woody Guthrie. "All You Fascists Bound to Lose." He was born on this day in 1912, and we went to break with Donna Summer, "Bad Girl," that she hit number one with on this day in 1979. We are here right now with our guest, Charlie Cobb. Charles Cobb is a journalist and a scholar and a writer and an activist who was in SNCC in the Civil Rights Movement and wrote the book, "This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible." And we went to break talking about the World War II veterans, and I think that is an important point that a few others have made, but you made it in a very different way, and the role that they played, and that the people willing to stand up, those in these different counties you talked about, who lived in some of these southern counties in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, and other places, were those in some ways who always stood up individually, but also knew...
Yes.
Go ahead. But also knew the limitations, and that this interaction between these young civil rights workers and these folks, these other older people, was something that kind of the interaction kind of helped create this movement, that synergy between the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one period bleeds over into the other.
Right.
So the World War I veterans obviously affect the World War II veterans and affect the political climate. Osceola McCain, for instance, a civil rights leader in South Carolina, you know, got so dismayed with the United States, she left the United States, opened up a cabaret in Belgium, in fact,
right,
and came back only because the Nazis had invaded Belgium. And he said, you know, and I came back with at least a splinter on my shoulder. And he was a World War I veteran, but he's agitating for social changes. He's affecting younger people who would become World War II veterans. And these guys go overseas and they shoot at Nazis or Japanese fascists And they come back and you see these individual actions all throughout the period of, say, of the bottom part of the 1940s, from 1946. And I talk about some of them in the book.
Yes.
Famous shootout in Columbia, Tennessee. Megger and Charles Evers attempting to register to vote in their little hometown in Mississippi. I mean, they're all, these stories exist all throughout the South. These are individual actions. Then you see gradually, you see an expansion of the NAACP during the same post-World War II period. And gradually, some of this begins to take the form of organized efforts. So the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, for instance, emerges in Mississippi, or the Progressive Voters League emerges in South Carolina, particularly after the 1954 Supreme Court decision. But you see, with this emerging civil rights activism, a tremendous expansion of the Ku Klux Klan in violence. And you also see the birth of the White Citizens Council, first in Mississippi, spreading across the South, and a dramatic decline in attempts at, say, voter registration after the 54 Supreme Court decision, and a dramatic outflow of black leaders who flee Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia because they're under assault and are being murdered for their civil rights activity. The great example during this period in my mind is Reverend George Lee, who was president of the NAACP in Belzoni, Mississippi, and the Knight Riders pull up beside his car as he's returning home from a meeting and just blow away the entire left side of his face. They find lead pellets in his jaw because apparently it was a shotgun blast, and the sheriff says, oh, it must be his teeth fillings.
So these
guys were all World War II veterans. Reverend Lee was a World War II veteran, too. And so you see this sharp decline until the student sit-ins erupt again. And the remaining leaders, adult leaders in Mississippi, are anxious to use that student energy for what they want in the communities that they lead. And in Mississippi, that was primarily voter registration.
And one of the things I think that you raised some issues here I think important to pursue after what you said, and I think that because a bunch of themes, at least for me reading the book, that came through as kind of subtext pushing this whole story. And one was this, you know, when the whole notion of violence versus nonviolence and the struggle that happened in the South, whether you look at the what you wrote about between Robert F. Williams in North Carolina, who we can describe, and Martin Luther King, or the whole notion that it's not nonviolence versus self-defense, is kind of a determination for resistance, and the words that people use in the book, like unviolent and nonviolence. There's a different way of looking. What you're doing is positing a different way of looking at that period and American history and where we may go in the future.
Yeah, and that was deliberate. Because I think people in the South don't have any trouble with understanding this. I think people looking at the civil rights movement who didn't participate in the movement may have a little trouble with it. The dichotomy that's made between violence and nonviolence is just false. People don't describe themselves that way. People said they were in the movement. And they could even say, I'm in the nonviolent movement as they're cleaning their rifles. And they didn't see any contradiction. Unviolent, for instance, which was a few worth long. Snick Field Secretary, that was his preferred use of the term. Or Hartman Turnbull, one of the legendary figures in Mississippi, after he drove the Knight Riders away who were attacking his farmhouse with his rifle. And if the rumor is true, he even killed one of them.
As you wrote, right.
That when we came up the next morning, and I'm quoting him exactly, he said, I wasn't being nonviolent. I was just protecting my family.
Right.
And that's how people think in real life. You know, they don't think in these terms of militant, radical, nonviolent, or violent. No, people saw themselves as being in the movement. And they saw us as the nonviolence because of the Freedom Rides and because of the sit-ins, which they really read about in newspapers or saw on television if they had a television or access to a television. But even that didn't stop them from asking us if we wouldn't like a gun. I have a very good friend from young, white, Jewish, from Brooklyn, New York, and she was staying with this family in one of the most violent parts of Mississippi. And the first thing the farmer she was staying with did was take her out to the pasture and begin to train her how to shoot a .45.
Right.
And she was with Snick. So, you know, people just didn't see this contradiction. And I would agree with them. More often than not, self-defense and nonviolence worked in tandem, not really in opposition to one another.
And I was,
even Martin Luther King had bodyguards, after all.
Exactly. And one of the interesting interactions you write in this book, and it made me think of Peniel Joseph's book that he wrote about Stokely that we talked about in this program a few months back, and the relationship Stokely had with Martin Luther King was that when Robert Williams, who led the NAACP in Monroe, North Carolina, taught us how about self-defense and fighting back and using guns at a World War II veteran, the interaction between Robert Williams and Martin Luther King in the magazine Liberator was really fascinating, and putting that out there.
Yeah, also, it's an interesting exchange between those two men, and more complex than usually portrayed if you read the whole exchange.
And that's what I found so interesting, because I think you also kind of, the complexity of this is what I was so interested in having people understand that took place in that period.
I think people have trouble. I think people have trouble with two things, aside from the way the whole top-down narrative has presented the civil rights movement. One, I think people have a lot of trouble getting their minds around the level of violence that existed in the South. So we're not talking about people getting beat up. We're talking about people getting murdered, you know, for simply trying to register to vote or something like that, or even speaking inappropriately to white people. And I think people have a lot of trouble understanding how violent this region was. This is not just a political argument. This was a murderous place, and there was no help coming from anywhere, and never had been since the emancipation of black people in 1863. And then I think people have trouble understanding gun culture as it functions in the South.
And gun culture is a huge piece of this. And let me take a little twist.
Yeah, it is, because it enabled blacks to keep and get weapons.
Right. And I think
when a Mississippi legislature, whose name escapes me at this particular moment, attempted to introduce gun control legislation in the middle 1950s, I mean, his bill never even got out of committee. And he was specific. When he introduced the gun legislation, he was specifically making the argument that we need it because too many blacks have guns. The bill never got out of committee.
And that
means you have a trouble understanding this gun culture.
And I think people still do in this country, and that makes me think of a couple of things that you wrote about in this book also that I think is important. One small part where you wrote that you can make the argument that the present-day defense of stand your ground in this country can be said, if you took Native American struggle out of the picture, could be said to have originated in the black community.
There is no doubt about that in my mind. Whether you're talking about slave rebellion, which is really fundamentally our defense of self from enslavement, whether through flight or otherwise, but always, almost in every instance, armed rebellion, or whether you talk about all the self-defense that emerged from the end of the Civil War all the way into the late 1960s. I mean, that's where Stand Your Ground took its roots. Unfortunately, this discussion of Stand Your Ground has become racialized because of how it's been used in recent years, particularly here in Florida, where I live. But it nonetheless, Stand Your Ground is Hartman Turnbow in Holmes County, Mississippi, or Robert Williams in Monroe, North Carolina, or the Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana, or the Union Leagues that emerged after the Civil War to protect political meetings. This is where the roots of Stand Your Ground are. And the roots of Stand Your Ground are simply are really common law in some ways. You don't really need Stand Your Ground legislation, but common law has long recognized the right to defend oneself when attacked. And it's wrongly applied. You know, I ask people all the time, well, suppose Trayvon Martin had a weapon, had killed the guy who killed him. Was he standing his ground? After all, he didn't know who was following. And this big guy, he's a young guy. If Trayvon Martin had killed him, that would have been the tradition, so to speak.
No, exactly. And I think that's so let me take a twist to the end before I come back to some other pieces of that I found like had interesting stories and themes running through the book. When you write later in the book that the power that and you can describe who she is for my listeners who don't know, you know, we've talked about it before on the air many times, that the spirit and power and politics and analysis and thinking of Ella Baker had on you, on the movement, but also on this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, the book is written in the spirit of Miss Baker, and we called her Miss Baker because by the time she made her way to us, she was 57 years old.
And you were 19, right?
19.
Right.
You know, she was Miss Baker, but she was a great figure, one of the great figures of 20th century social change. There would have been no SCLC without Miss Baker. She's the one who organized it, became its first temporary executive director, temporary because she was a woman and these preachers had a lot of trouble with a woman at her level engaged in policy and decision making. She's the one who brought the young people together who would later form SNCC. She was the one who raised with us, because it wasn't in our heads, bottom-up organized. You know, strong people don't need strong leaders, she would say. And always encouraged us to keep our ears close to the ground, at the grassroots, and listen to what people said, because people, ordinary people, made sharecroppers, day workers, babysitters, and all these people, they knew what they wanted. You know, they knew what they didn't like. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." And if you got to know the people, you know, you'd find, here's where you would also find the movement. And she was tremendous, arguably the most influential adult on us, Ella Baker. I could go on and on and on about her story.
Well, we'll have to do that one day in a show just dedicated to Ella Baker all day long.
I'm for that.
But I raise it because I'm thinking about what you think some of this portends about where we go. Because you wrote very eloquently towards the back of the book about while this whole tradition of self-defense and resistance and standing up is part of a tradition in this country, a tradition especially in the Black community, communities of color and in labor, that people standing up for what's confronting them. You also began to write about nonviolence is a difficult way to live a life because it's hard for most of us to even think about how you live a nonviolent life. We're not Gandhi, and most people will never be Gandhi in America or anywhere else. But that you were talking about how the coming out of this discussion on self-defense, that the notion of re-talking about what nonviolence means may be important for the community now.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about this at more than one level. One is, you know, we're faced right now, certainly in inner cities, with this tremendous problem of violence. People of color killing people of color, essentially. I mean, that's where there are roughly 30,000 deaths by guns in the United States annually. 60% of those deaths are suicide. That's the issue of mental health now. But another 10% are homicides in Black and Latino communities. I only see that playing out in Detroit and Chicago and in Indianapolis and all sorts of cities. So one question, and I don't elaborate on it very much in the book, it just seems to me that one question is, can you get a nonviolent movement in these communities? Is there, it's noticeable that the legacy of nonviolence, despite its demonstrable success, has not made its way into American life in general and Black life specifically. We're inclined to engage in acts of violence, retaliatory violence. We have virtually no discussion by even proponents of nonviolence in the most violence-racked communities of the country. And see, to me, that's a tremendous organizing mission that needs to be taken up by someone. That legacy. What does the legacy of nonviolent struggle mean for us in the 21st century? Remember, the Southern movement was aimed at specific goals, voter registration, desegregation of public accommodations, reducing, if not ending, inequality in public schooling. It was never a mission to just get people committed to nonviolence. There's never been a nonviolent movement aimed at encouraging nonviolence in the United States. It's always been mission-oriented. Well, maybe now it's time to think, and it's ironic that I'm raising this in a book about guns, but now may be a time to think about whether or not you can actually have a nonviolent movement for the express purpose of getting people committed to nonviolence as a way of resolving problems today. And I sort of just mentioned that towards the end of the book.
Well, I thought it was important because to me it also said if you kind of address that, as you mentioned, numerous people are, as they are here in Baltimore and other places, are really kind of addressing doing that on the community level that we never hear about, that if you turn that around, then that energy that is focused inward with violence could be externalized and it could become resistance to the condition people live in.
Yeah, resisting the conditions people live in is part of it, but in a way I'm raising something perhaps more abstract. You know, we've always used, and not just black people, labor unions too, for instance, nonviolence as a tactic. Sit-ins,
right.
Picket lines, protests of various kinds, anti-war protests and the like. But we've never had a movement for nonviolence in and of itself in this country. How would you do that if you wanted to organize that? Well, it's something I raised towards the end of the book. I didn't offer any solutions or any ways and means. I just raised the idea.
I think it was important to be raised. And I think that one of the things you also, another one of the subtext for me in this book I wanted to get to before we conclude our discussion was that many times during the course of your writing, you talk about the kind of racist attacks on the black community in the South, but you also talk about the politics of it and Bilbo and the overt racism and the use of the N-word and going after people, but you also talk in here, which I think is really important, that there was this moment when there was this change in rhetoric by the white power in the South because they saw themselves losing by being overtly racist. And I really felt, and I felt a connection between that and the kind of rhetoric we're hearing today, which makes it so hard to define what people are saying is racist because you can't find it the way it's being said in some ways.
Yeah, the kind of blatant racist expression and practice that typified Southern life and in many respects Northern life too when it comes to work, jobs, and housing, you can't really get away with today. And that discussion began way back in really the 1930s. Again, it's a complex discussion, far too complex to do much with here. But sophisticated white Southerners said, A, we have to win the support of Northerners for our acts of white supremacy and racism. And to do that, we have to use a different language. You know, and that began to unfold in the 1930s, 1940s. And remember, and by the 1940s, and the other important aspect of this is after World War II, the United States found itself in competition with the Soviet Union to influence newly emerging nations, mostly black and brown nations, that were now fighting against colonialism and in most instances winning their fight against colonialism. And they were explicit racism and segregation undermine the United States argument that it represented freedom and democracy, not when they can see Freedom Rider buses being blown up or assassinations and the like. So you begin to see a shift in rhetoric here.
And I we can spend a whole other hour just talking about how that's connected to the very conservative movement today, but we can't.
Other point I want to try and make in the book is you can't disconnect the kind of white supremacist racist systems that we had in the South from the founding of the country itself.
Right.
There's a founding contradiction. We're up against these issues in the 1960s because of how the country was founded. The country was founded on slavery. It's Thomas Jefferson's wonderful rhetoric in the Declaration of Independence, notwithstanding it, he was probably served tea by one of the 200 slaves he had as he was writing it.
Or being carried on the pillow, as you wrote about.
Oh, yeah, and that's his earliest childhood memory, according to Roger Wilkins, who wrote a book on some of the founding fathers, was being carried on a pillow by a slave.
So I just think this book is especially history in the beginning, but also what you talk about in throughout this book is important. And we have maybe 2 minutes left, and I just want to make a very quick connection here. Maybe that you know, you write about the crazy black folks like James Evers and Hamer's mother.
Yeah.
I love those quotes from Hamer's mom, but that to me that there is a direct connection between them and the civil rights activists coming to the South, and the explosion of things like Deacons for Defense and other groups. You know what I'm saying? There's a lineage there.
Yeah, there definitely is, and that lineage really is a Southern lineage. You know, people coming to the South, such as me, is less important than the people who emerge from the South to take on leadership of the Southern freedom movement. You know, so in some respects, I was a little different. There were only four of us from outside of Mississippi in 1962 working full-time in the state. Bob Moses, Frank Smith from Morehouse College in Atlanta, and myself, well, three of us. Everybody else, including the people my own age, emerged from Mississippi. The Southern movement, in other words, was led by Southerners. Mississippi's movement was led by Mississippi. And that's important to understand.
I think that's a very critical point to understand. And Charlie, I wish we had another hour to do this, but maybe another day. And I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you for inviting me.
This Nonviolent Self Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. We will be connecting to this on our website. It's a book that should be read. And really wrestled with, and I would suggest groups read it together and really ponder and wrestle with what this means about our history and also about our present and our future. Charlie Cobb, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about the book.
We'll take a brief break. On our way out of here, we are hearing The Ballad of Baltimore Rebellion by Ryan Harvey. This is the day the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 began, on this day in Baltimore, and we'll be talking about a book just written about that in the coming days. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we meet Tyrone West family and community activists on this one-year anniversary of his death at the hands of the Baltimore police. Stay with us.
The governor sent in troops to stop it, protecting the railroad profit, but they were outnumbered by the crowd. So President Hayes sent troops to fight, shot a man and broke the strike, and strike breakers rolled those engines out.